be or is very likely bots and other AI programs. Even the comments, you know, like going back to our original, the beer keg party 70s photo, you know, you mentioned at the beginning that there's 4,800 or close to 5,000 or whatever comments. How many of those are real people? We enter this weird sort of internet, almost like living cemetery, where there's activity with no one behind the screen.
That is a facet, or that's a notion that's referenced in the article as well. The dead internet theory, I'll just read from the article a little bit. Dead internet theory, the only slightly tongue-in-cheek idea inspired by the increasing amount of fake, suspicious, and just plain weird content, that humans are a tiny minority online, and the bulk of the internet is made by and for AI bots, creating bot content for bot followers who comment and argue with other bots. The rise of AI slop has, appropriately, the shape of a good science fiction yarn, a mysterious wave of noise emerging from nowhere, an alien invasion of semi-coherent computers babbling in human-like voices from some vast electronic beyond. So it is a... I think that this has been a question... This is demonstrably true on places like Twitter. Sometimes people refer to it as X, but in any case... On Facebook, I think the verification is a bit more sound, but nonetheless, you would, at the rate at which AI slop gets shared, the way that when you try to think about it critically or you try to enjoy it at all, it just falls right over. You would think this is for bots, and you would think that everyone responding to it who enjoys it is a bot, right?
It's very odd, disturbing. It's also... on some level seems like it's becoming self-defeating, like people are becoming real people, like myself and you, are becoming exhausted by or pushed out of realms of social media activity that we would have otherwise been active in, because I don't want to participate with a bunch of fake, not real automated accounts.
No, absolutely, yeah. And if you can know that ahead of time, it's very easy to spot it. It's just like you get the same kind of phony vibe from AI bots. You can just tell the reason that this happens, so there is the question of like, okay, well, if this is bad for community, if this is bad for creating content that is genuine or something like that, why do people do this? If there's some kind of fraud going on where, you know, a post gets a bunch of engagement and they make money from that, which is true, the article goes into how Facebook has a bonus program where people are incentivized to try and get content that gets high engagement, and they're paid for this. I assume because advertisers want to have people looking at content, then they can advertise to those people. I think one of the reasons why you would do this is you can sacrifice some of the numbers. So like your post gets 10,000 comments or something like that. Maybe 3,000 of them are bots, so you only get paid for 7,000 of them. But you retain that 7,000 genuine comments more because it looks like more people are engaging with it. The way that I think about bot activity is decoys in hunting. So say you want to attract geese from the sky, they just fall from the sky. You lay out some geese, some fake geese, and those geese will land there, and then they're easy to take out, right? So I think that bot activity, you can't go to Facebook and be like, hey, we have 10,000 people commenting on this, and be like, no, 3,000 of them are bots. Okay, well, you still got 7,000, and you started that pool with 3,000 bots engaging in that, and then it just snowballed from there. So I think that that is one of the reasons that bot activity might be incentivized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes, you know, on some level, it makes sense. And then the question is, okay, well, is the internet, you know, we talk about dead internet theory, is that really dead? Is the internet really not working, right? All this kind of stuff, you know, if the mass is just getting decoyed into operating on the internet. But I think there's a couple other things to think about. One is, you know, what kind of content is being promoted in this process and why, which has kind of been the thrust of this conversation so far since the beginning of talking about the 1970s are now, by this point in the episode, the now infamous 1970s keg party photograph. But also, too, you know, the article that we're talking about as well, we start to see, okay, well, this is how AI bots operate on a place like, say, Twitter or Facebook, which already can be nefarious enough because of the political implications or the, you know, false truths that can be promoted easily, et cetera, whatever, right? But then, as the article states, there are other ways in which these bots and AI programs operate, which is perhaps even more concerning. That's particularly around research and scientific activities in academia, where basically, you know, the whole peer-reviewed paper system is under threat because people can effectively pump out papers that are created by AI, and then they can also pump out papers that are created by AI that they can then use in reference notations for those papers. And so you can build a whole pyramid of basically fake, poorly done, you know, bodies of ostensibly scientific work, which undermine the credibility of the much larger scientific community, and can also be used to, again, prop up or push very particular narratives, right? If I can create a whole, you know, in theory, if I wanted to push flat earth stuff, that's my thing now. Well, using AI, I can now easily push out a bunch of crappy books and a bunch of research papers and a bunch of other research papers and articles and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And all these things can reference each other into what is effectively a completely fabricated mountain of evidence for something that obviously is not the case.
So much right. For coherence epistemology.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's like a complete tainting of coherence epistemology. Well, if we have all these things that connect like to each other and build a super strong web, then it must be true. You know, look at the weight of all this evidence and it all feeds on each other. So it makes complete sense, et cetera, et cetera. Right.
Yeah.
And it's very weird and problematic. And, you know, I think maybe we can look at some other stuff too, but I think it's also too, as we've been discussing, that it also feeds off of very particular emotional directions and social directions that, you know, that we are currently in, with nostalgia being the biggest.
The scale of moving from outrage to nostalgia, we see that implicit rage or that implicit anger in nostalgia as a reaction from the present to the past, a sort of yearning for it. There is a movement toward, I think there's a recognizable movement or a shift in sort of the social media zeitgeist, if you will, towards the emotional tone of nostalgia, as it were.
As part of our discussion for today, we also reviewed a very small section of a chapter of a book by Andrew Potter, who is a philosopher. He's a professor at the Max Bell School of Public Policy. He's a former journalist, primarily he's Canadian-based, but he wrote a short book a few years ago called On Decline, which really covers, like, you know, the cultural and so you know, the at least seeming or perceived cultural and social decline of our current era. And one of the main facets of that, unsurprisingly, is nostalgia. And he has quite a good short little review of what nostalgia looks like. And also, as we'll talk about a little further, how this nostalgia concept has radically shifted and changed with these new media mediums. So here we go. I'm going to read for all of us, and then we can discuss after. But just starting off, it says, the satirical website The Onion once ran a story with the headline, U.S. Department of Retro warns we may be running out of the past. The conceit was that retro consumption, that is, the open pit mining of our pulp culture past, was creeping ever closer to the present. Where kids in the 80s held 50s-themed dance parties, by the mid-90s, people were already waxing nostalgic for the halcyon days of late 80s hair metal. The story's fake source, commented that this rapidly shrinking gap between retro and the present day is like a noose closing ever tighter around the neck of the American quiche. First published in 1997, this piece predicted that we'd be out of the past to romanticize about by 2005, stating, for the first time in history, a phenomenon and nostalgia for that particular phenomenon will actually meet. I actually have an interesting example of this, but we'll finish reading. They were only off by about 5 years. The past decade having seen the culmination of what's been called nostalgia for the present. The framing and romanticizing of an event or era even as it's occurring. The Onion article wasn't so much satire as an incredibly prescient take on how our culture would evolve under the enormous selection pressures of digital media. It's almost impossible to distinguish nostalgia craze from a consumer craze anymore. Nostalgia is a form of consumerism, and consumerism is now little more than the dip of a credit card into the river of nostalgia that runs through our social media feeds. As it evolves in the dominant mood of the 20th century, nostalgia culture has just become the culture, one where consumer crazes and social media shivers amount to little more than the context-free creation of the past. From this perspective, our obsession with nostalgia is just the flip side of the ideology-free internal present of the end of history. Unmoored and disconnected from how history has actually unfolded, everything from Victorian-era motifs to Cold War symbolism to survivalist masculine posturing all gets funneled into pop culture maw, from which it later emerges as one facet or another of contemporary popular culture. At one level, the current obsession with nostalgia can be read as a straightforward response to rapid technological change. The world is crazy, fast-paced, and fragmented. Our every moment is a flood of texts and DMs and TikTok videos and memes, all of which pass by in endless streams, seemingly without connection to anything but the passing show. But this nostalgia on demand also points to an event even more powerful force driving the cultural moment, which is nostalgia as the principal product of our most popular technologies. Video game nostalgia and retro consoles are a huge market. Remember Pokemon Go? The insanely popular app-based game from 2015 that saw crowds of civilians wandering the streets, stumbling into dead bodies, into crime traps, and even to their own deaths? Its initial appeal leaned heavily on the nostalgia of the original Game Boy version of Pokemon, which for many kids was one of the first video games they loved as kids. Sorry, yeah. There are countless other websites devoted to the creation of the past, including the straightforwardly named Nostalgia Machine, where you enter a given year and get served up a screen populated with links to the Billboard hits of the time. And then there's social media. Facebook has its own On This Day feature. Twitter has a function that lets you see how your timeline looked any number of years earlier, while Instagram has at-the-ready filters to give you any pic the look of a Polaroid that's been fading into a photo album for decades. If you're careless enough to upload your phone's pictures to a cloud service like Google's Photos, you'll get a daily nostalgia montage of photos you took on this date 1, 2, or 3, or 4 years ago. You can now spend your days wallowing in the past. Indeed, many of us do. Our culture has become a form of nostalgia as service. We are forever trapped in our online world, going round and round on an all-encompassing digital version of Don Draper's famous carousel for Mad Men. Some psychologists see this as a good thing, since nostalgia can serve as an emotional ballast by keeping us grounded in something certain. Where nostalgia was once seen as a malady, a mental illness to be cured, it's now being interpreted as a healthy correction to the past, to the fast pace of the modern world. The new wisdom is that nostalgia can serve as a cultural security blanket, offering a quantum of comfort or happiness in a world gone crazy. Missed in all this is the essence of the nostalgic mood, which is not so much about remembering, but misremembering. Nostalgia only works when we deliberately ignore certain aspects of the past and deliberately foreground other elements. It's about seeing the past in a very specific way, as more innocent, naive, authentic than the present. All nostalgia is therefore fundamentally about our present feelings of disquiet or unhappiness, a state that always compares poorly with the past. And as harmless and inward as that might seem, it actually has enormous political implications. Underneath a nostalgia's happy-go-lucky veneer is something a lot darker: identity politics, populism, and culture wars. So that was a reading from Andrew Potter's book On Decline, which I think really captures not just nostalgia, but particularly what nostalgia is within the context of our current media landscape, particularly the mediums of media's philosophy of, the philosophy of technology that we're talking about here, and how nostalgia has kind of morphed into, in many ways, the base sort of feeling or emotive go-to. And I wanted to say, he says, a phenomenon and nostalgia for the past, a phenomenon and the nostalgia for that particular phenomenon will actually meet. What's an example of that? Because one of the things that he's talking about, which I think is really important for our understanding of nostalgia and also just consumerism today, something that was really interestingly brought up by a number of other thinkers on the topic as well, is that these circles get tighter, right? Like, kind of at the beginning of that reading, it says how, it used to be that, whatever decade you were as a youth, when you're sort of at the cultural vanguard of that period, right? It would usually be multiple decades back that you would peer into the past, the time before your parents were young. That was the really cool time. It's the 80s, it's the 90s, let's pull from the 50s. Like, that was, they were cool then, they had cool cars, interesting, all this, they were rebellious, James Dean, whatever it's going to be. Now those cycles get very tight. They've tightened up more and more and more and more, so that now it's almost like you're referencing the present. And I was trying to think to myself, what is an example of this? Examples would be, to me, would be compilation videos, and in particular, politically charged and important compilation videos. The most obvious example I can come up with is Trump. If you go on YouTube or any other social media platform, there is a plethora of, the best of Trump videos. These are his best moments. These are him giving his greatest hits, the best gotchas, the best burns, his wildest moments. These videos are enormously popular, and all of this stuff is, well, not literally from today. Most of it is very, very recent, within the past, 8 years or so, right? And it's the recycling of this same sort of, here he is, look how he got, won over on everybody or screwed everybody over or shut them down or whatever, as an example of this kind of very tightly wound nostalgic reflection.
I don't have a specific example, but this is a sort of structure or frame that I've been trying to think about for a while. And it's just occurred to me that it does have this structural similarity with nostalgia, and which is vanity or vainglory. And I've always kind of recognized it as having a memory work aspect to it. I'm thinking specifically, say someone's going to do something awesome and they say, watch this, because you guys are going to remember this for the rest of your lives. They're almost in saying this, what they're doing is they're projecting forward and saying, you guys are going to remember this moment and you're going to be nostalgic about right now. You're going to remember this and you're going to be happy you were here, but you have to go into that future in order to then look at the present as the past, right? And that's sort of the structure of vanity and vaingloriousness. So if you think about any kind of fantasy, like a rock star fantasy or something, you had your comeuppance or whatever, and now you're just sitting here doing your thing. It's not really that impressive, but later on, this is going to look, it's going to be like a really formative experience for you,
The logic of nostalgia, when you really think about it, almost doesn't make sense. Because reading again from this, from the article here, the nostalgic mood, which is not so much about remembering, but misremembering, Nostalgia only works when we deliberately ignore certain aspects of the past and deliberately foreground other elements. Nostalgia is always going to be about, like, reflecting about, like, you know, the past and idealizing certain aspects of the past, diminishing the quality of the present, focusing on the present's negative attributes. There's this weird thing going on where it's like nostalgia can work on any past moment, right? Like, we can, and especially when we see this manufactured nostalgia, it can look anywhere, point to any, you find it, you know, looking at the 2000s, fantastic time, amazing, incredible, it was so great. The 60s, oh, the best time, was so great, incredible. Vietnam War, how fun was that? The 80s is like the biggest one, right? For some reason, Reagan, best president ever, obviously. People will be nostalgic about now. If there's any truth to nostalgia at all, if you should pay any attention to it, shouldn't you be able to find those positive qualities that you will one day be nostalgic about in the future, about now, in the present? Doesn't it not, in itself, when you think about it, start to cancel out that negation? Is it just today? Is it just our present moment that no one's ever going to be nostalgic for? Like, you would think that those special aspects that people will reflect on, if they're real, are here and now, and we're living through them, and that's what's, you know, and there's, you know, there's positive qualities to the present, obviously. I think that the simple answer is that, like Andrew Potter says, that nostalgia is such a interesting and dangerous tool because it's more or less all made up.
I think that's the significant thing about remembering the 80s. And you ask, why do people remember the 80s so much? Well, the reason that the 80s were so great, here's one nostalgic reason, it's the explosion of consumer electronics, right? People finally are getting their hands on all kinds of neat gadgets coming out of the post-war economic miracle that was Japan, right? They're getting all kinds of fun stuff. And it's nostalgic getting, you know, this, like a Walkman or something, like, for Christmas, you know, it's fun. He does mention, it's escaping my mind now who wrote it, but nostalgia is always kind of predicated upon a misremembering. And I think that's one way you can think of that as well, as a kind of repression. So in order to remember how fun consumer electronics are, you had to kind of forget the conditions under which those arose, which was like the Reagan era and stuff like that. So you have to be selective in your memory, and that's why all nostalgia is memory work in a certain way. You can't just go to a memory you have from the 80s, if you have any at all, and be nostalgic for it. You actually have to, like, do some kind of nostalgic digestion in order to have a nostalgic memory. You have to scrub some of the bad stuff, idealize some of the good stuff, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why nostalgia gets a, maybe like deservedly, but always astutely seen, kind of rap as being sentimental, because you have to be selective and biased in that way. But I think it's interesting too, because it also explains one of the reasons why, and I've always thought that this is not that actually that unusual, which is nostalgia for, you know, times you weren't alive in. Like, I wasn't alive in the 80s, but I can have nostalgia for the 80s. We can explain that because it's all memory. Like, it's essentially memory work. You go back to, you have this, like, evoked aesthetic of the 80s, consumer electronics, camcorders and stuff like that, and you just there is, like, certain positive associations with that. You know, you're the cameraman, you're the DJ, you are listening to the radio, you're recording stuff, you've got your walkie-talkie, you're an operator, that's fun. Now you just cycle that, you cycle those memories that you have yourself through that positive lens, and you kind of, in a way, decontextualize it from all the bad stuff.
Yeah, you absolutely are able to. And it's not even just your, like, the way nostalgia functions, obviously, especially now within the context of nostalgia being such a, I don't know what, you, like, I'm trying to think, like, such a concept, a vein within, like, our current mediums of media, is that it's also incredibly public and collective, right? It's never, like, nostalgia is rarely utilized in a way where it's like, oh, do you specifically remember your great time? You know, I'm like, I'm sitting around, I'm an old man now, and I'm being nostalgic for when me and my wife went on our big road trip in the 70s through the U.S. The nostalgic content, the feeling, the illicitness of it, often has a flavor which is far more public. And I think that's, you know, going back to, as we come to a close, like going back to our keg party photo, the description, you know, about like just how the community was pure and people had fun. You know, these are all public. This is an AI writing that, so it's not actually observing anything, but it's designed to be public observations that anyone can relate to, that anyone can participate in, that anyone can want, can have this wanting of, that is regardless of the whether or not they actually lived in, you know, 1970s North Carolina and went to keg parties all the time. They might be 20 years old growing up in Britain, or, you know, 90 in Japan. The, you know, the actual facts of their, of the history, time, place that they lived through is completely irrelevant to the manufactured emotional responses that people have.
Their nostalgia is memory work. They are memories in a certain way. They're the products of memories, but they're depersonalized, right? They're not anyone's memories, it seems. Like, what would a, like, I guess you could talk to someone who has a nostalgic memory. I mean, you would get those from real people, whereas the posts that we're talking about, the ones that evoke nostalgia, that set you out to talk about your own personal memories, those are not personal themselves. They're just there to elicit it. And the other has to do with desire, right? Which is why I think that this reads like an ad in a certain way. It's not trying to sell anything, but I don't, like, I personally don't think that the purpose of advertising is to sell anything anyway. I think the purpose of an advertisement is to install a desire, but that's precisely what this is doing, right? Which is why I think that they feel like the same thing, and probably why nostalgia, if nostalgia is on the rise and if it's doing anything to displace like rage bait or angry content, it's because it can sit next to advertisements better than rage, better than anger. It's more congruent with a media landscape that just is predicated upon desiring and being a desiring subject.
Nostalgia is like more generalized, easily elicitable feeling that can encompass, but more implicitly, those same central emotive responses that have become so important to the proliferation of viral and online media, right? Like, within nostalgia, you can have love, you can have, you know, a feeling of community, but you can also have, again, this generally very implicit, anger, frustration, disappointment, and you're going to have all these things wrapped into one package that is really easily, I guess you could say, just really easily shareable, viral, really easily relatable, and has a whole bunch, which we didn't really get into it, but a whole bunch of different political dimensions.
This has been excellent. Thank you for joining me, Hale, and thank you for joining us on this episode. We've been discussing nostalgia and AI, the way that they relate to one another. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. Join us again.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started, so I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.